the biggest thing in the world right now is artificial intelligence and generative AI. Generative because it generates something. To talk to me today on the Stuff podcast about how this quite remarkable new set of technologies is changing the world is FNB's Chief Data and Analytics Officer, Dr. Christoph Nivot. Firstly, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Toby, thanks. And yeah, we're very excited to talk about this topic.
I'm really glad when I see you at FNB functions, I make a point of sitting at your table because the conversations we've had over the years have been quite remarkable. I first met you when you were the CEO of FNB Consumer, and you've expanded what your understanding of consumer behavior is to, you know, the broader bank as a whole, and you've gone back to your roots as an electrical engineer.
Yeah, thanks, Toby. Yeah, that was, I mean, a big thing for me. I really love the consumer role, understanding customers and the amount of data that it generates that allows us to give customers that personalized experience with the bank, and then really the ability now to use that on a data analytics platform where we can pull all of that together. And just improve our service delivery, whether that's on the billions of transactions we process, the trillion rand of lending we have in South Africa, investments, etc. All of these are data driven now.
I mean, the numbers you've told me of is it 54 trillion rand of transactions.
The value of payments that our customers did in the last year across FNB and the other brands, obviously in the wider group, including, you know, RMB, WesBank, etc.
And all of that's happening in milliseconds.
Absolutely. So that has to happen immediately when customers make a payment. It needs to happen. So you need to check it, you know, whether it's for fraud and fin crime, you absolutely have to check every one of these. So that is a huge driver of analytical volumes.
Yes.
And it just gives you a bit of an example. If you think, what does data analytics do in the bank? That's a very practical experience of, you know.
Yeah. And the more data you have, the more you've got to analyze. But then again, you've still got to analyze it. I mean, I think that's kind of where generative AI comes in. One of the best descriptions I've heard of it is the analyst Benedict Evans called it infinite interns. And that's a great idea because you got a smart person who, you know, goes through your data. I'm much more impressed by closed systems like Microsoft's Copilot. You know, it'll search through specifically the information related to, say, this podcast. Please remind me of Christoph's title, his current title. That I think is a much more powerful application. And I'm sure within the F&B environment, you know, your financial data, Gibbs professor told me during a panel last week, was the second most important data after healthcare, and you guys have got that, and you're in an extraordinary position to not only make yourselves more money, but like make your customers' lives easier or offer them higher credit ratings, and all of that happens even easier now.
Yeah, Toby, I mean, that's a great point. I think generative AI has really revolutionized what you can use machines for. So the traditional AI now, we call it traditional now. I mean, being able to do, for example, fingerprint recognition in the branch, or to do facial recognition for a selfie, or to be able to scan documents and convert them, or even to do more complex nonlinear analysis, you know, for fraud and for credit or whatever else. That was largely, people didn't see that because it happened behind, you know, closed door. You may know that it's happening or not, but now generative AI has really brought it into the mainstream because with these large language models are able to understand English and all other languages and computer languages.
And mathematics. I don't speak as a first language, but you clearly do.
Maths, statistics, you know, chemistry, physics, these are not all relevant for us. But the fact is, actually, we work in the knowledge economy and we work with language. I mean, so by and large, other than the automated transactions that happen, the ability to give our customer service and that they are able to ask in English or in whatever language they want to in future potentially, and be able to give them contextual, accurate answers that are based on information that we have in the bank, that is absolutely transformational.
I mean, in a sense, in you know, to coin a phrase, the world has gone from generic to really personalized.
Yeah, and personalized doesn't mean actually people think it's maybe less human.
Yeah.
But often we find that, like in one of our studies, that we're using AI to help our agents write better replies to customers, and it's integrated into our stack. So it actually has access to, like, let's say Microsoft Dynamics in terms of customer information. The AI replies that our staff then use to answer are actually much more sensitive in terms of the wording. It can be accurate, it's well structured, etc. And you find that in other studies as well, that people find that actually one of the big things of using generative AI is that it actually gives the customer an experience that they prefer over what the human, you know, who is in a hurry and whose time is limited, was able to cobble together for them.
Exactly. I mean, what's wrong with you? Why are you trying to make our lives better?
I think generative AI is really revolutionizing the knowledge economy. So all of us that work basically as knowledge workers, you know, that is going to be a really powerful tool where you are either, you know, if you're not using these tools, we always say AI is not going to take your job, but somebody using AI could well take your job.
That's a really great line, because that typifies the essence of this new technology does what the old technology did, only better. And if you don't use it, someone else will use it. And there's that phrase, the kings of one era are very seldomly the kings of another era. And you see that often in the changes. You know, Nokia sold 2 out of 3 feature phones in the world. Along came BlackBerry. It's owned the pre-smartphone, you know, messaging environments. It barely existed anymore. You know, the changes are quite profound, and that's only been in the last 20 years. Some of the biggest computer companies I grew up with just don't exist anymore.
Yeah, everybody is having to reinvent themselves. I'll just try to get a little bit back to maybe F&B, right? So in terms of like what we would do as a white chief data analytics officer, even this role didn't really exist. This was created 3 years ago. I wrote and I spoke to our CEO at that point in time and said, we should really create this role at the group level. And now, you know, we've got more than 20 CDIOs in the structure. And the thinking was really that previously data used to be confined to BI and MI, so business or management intelligence, and that would actually often report to a CFO, or it would be sitting in an operations area or an IT. And it was not strategic. It was just a tool for management to be able to pull some reports and manage their business as well. But where it has evolved to is analytics has become a very big part of what we do in the bank. So if you want to satisfy your customers' needs, and let's say we process our customers make 2.5 billion payments last year, totaling 54 trillion rand across the group. That's a very, very big 54 trillion rand of payments. Now, that includes inter-account transfers inside the same entity, etc. So that's not all revenue or cost, but you can imagine that is a huge, huge amount of payments. Now, all of those, every single one, has to be checked from a fraud perspective, has to be checked from a FICA perspective in terms of fin crime. We have to make sure that these transactions can settle, that there's appropriate liquidity. That's just one part of it. And then we build the data products based on
this. And all of this happens, like, you know, in milliseconds.
It has to happen automatically, because you absolutely just cannot do that with humans.
I stop every now and again and think, this is just extraordinary. This is what we think of as normal. You know, I'm old enough to remember where, you know, you went into the bank with a book, and you wrote in the book, and if you didn't write it in the book, it didn't exist, you know, and you took the book home, and, you know, and it was at Barclays that became an F&B just up the road. That was my first account to Bob, you know, and I mean, it's just extraordinary. I was one of the first, I've been told, 50 users. A friend of mine worked on the first project for one of the other banks and didn't tell them I was a journalist. And I actually had an account at the bank at the time, NetBank, as they called it. And I've been using all of this technology. I mean, it's extraordinary. 54 trillion rands worth of transactions happening, you know, and there was a time where you'd have those computers as servers on your premises. Now, everything's in the cloud and it's safer and more secure. It's a total turnaround of what was the bedrock of what a bank was, which was you kept the gold in your own vault. Now it's a totally different ecosystem where you partner with other people. You're not a cloud service provider. You partner with one. You do what you're good at. And it's extraordinary. And the thing that I think is amazing is this is not the end. This is just where we are in 2024.
Yeah, it is evolving. So, I mean, obviously in F&B, we still run very large data centers ourselves. So a lot of the line of business systems are still in our data centers. But the areas that I look after, we have largely migrated to cloud. So in terms of, let's say we deployed 120 new models last year, the vast bulk of these models are deployed into cloud. And, you know, we have got services from all three of the hyperscalers. They are now, I mean, AWS has been in South Africa for a long time. Azure has been here for a relatively long time. And now in February, GCP, Google Cloud Platform, also went live in South Africa. And they all have complementary services that actually is difficult to replicate on-premise fully. Yeah. They actually provide that infrastructure if you want to have an air-gapped solution on-prem, but that's quite expensive.
Yeah.
And really what you want is the flexibility to be able to scale solutions to customers and to roll them out very quickly.
Server room first language, for instance, which I bet you a big bank does.
Absolutely. If you are constrained and you want to deploy this and they tell you, well, actually, we're going to need to order more servers or install more memory and whatever to make this. I mean, then whereas in the cloud, you can spin up labs in seconds. Obviously, that is within the whole security framework. So you mentioned, I mean, the data privacy aspects, the cybersecurity, and all of that. But once you have it in place and you have a blueprint for that, it does make deploying solutions really easy, whether they're on-prem or in cloud.
So let's just talk about what it is you're getting, because it's interesting that you remind us of the origins of what was once called business intelligence. You had this data. Could you get it to run in a report? Could you get it to run on the same day? Could you close all your stores? Say you pick and pay and you want to look at all your stores and you can know what you sold and where and restock inventory, to the point where this stuff is available within seconds. You can update a dashboard if you want to, and you can know exactly what's happening all over your business and what to focus on, where people are spending money, you know, where you could improve. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, just give a bit more detail on that. So we're organized, for example, in our segments. So in F&B, we have retail, we have commercial. Obviously, there's the corporate bank in the R&B side, corporate and institutional. We've got broader Africa. Obviously, F&B has got, we've got banks there as well. And what we do from an analytics platform is we give an enterprise view of that. So I've mentioned Transact would be one of them, but that's, I guess, one of the big functions of a bank. And another very big function of a bank is lending, where we play a major role. So if you think about it, in South Africa, in aggregate, we lend more than R1 trillion to customers across the entire continent, and including the UK, the number is a lot bigger than that. But all of that lending requires quite a lot of analytics.
Yes.
In many cases, we are already, if you bank with F&B, you will be able to see offers before you've even applied for them, because we have effectively pre-scored you. We'll publish 400 billion rand of retail offers at any given point in time that are immediately available for take-up. And really, I guess, obviously, there's NCA, there's other requirements that you have to meet. So there's a few things that you have to tick. But we have really done extensive work to pre-vet you.
Great.
Then there's the disbursement, you know, whether that's unsecured, secured, including, you know, vehicle asset finance on the West Bank side, trying to make the process as easy and slick as possible for good customers, to really give them what they want. You often want customers, they need to know before they want to buy a house or a car what they can afford. That puts them in a significantly better negotiating position than, you know, trying to compete with other people on an offer and people don't know if they're good for the credit and, you know, what it is. So that's really then ongoing risk management on that from a credit side. Provisioning has become very complex. The accountants have come up with very complicated formulas or approaches. You know, so IFRS 9
doesn't sound
on
like
the
an
banking
accountant
side,
at all.
IFRS 17 on the insurance side. These are so complicated, you need specialized actuaries to build the models for that. Now, obviously, that is also something that would sit in our world. And then lastly, there's the capital models that really say how much capital do you need to keep against those. So just in lend alone, you can imagine the number of models that are there across the different, let's say, customer groups, across the different products, etc., and to really span that. That's a big part of what we do in data analytics, because people wonder, what is it, what do you do? We really support that, obviously, with the credit people, which I used to be a big part of that community, obviously, in terms of taking the decisions on how the portfolio is run, what the risk appetite is, and so more.
How will AI help that process? Because that's a very complex, very technical, and I'm sure ripe for optimization, like everything.
That is always a great question. Ironically, let's say AI models per se, so more non-linear decision making, etc., ran quite heavily in other processes in the bank, like fingerprint recognition or selfie, and then in the fraud space I mentioned before, a lot of those models. In the credit provisioning and capital, because it's quite regulated, the typical models to meet the explainability, lack of bias, fairness, etc., those models are typically somewhat simpler. They're often just like a logistic regression. But the designing the features for these, if you have tens of thousands of features that you could theoretically have at a customer level, we'd use, you know, whether you call it machine learning or not, you know, let's say principal component analysis, or other techniques to simplify that to the point where you can take these features into credit decisioning processes. And then on the judgmental credit side, you wouldn't be surprised, but the amount of paperwork, not physical paper, but writing that we still do in assessing credit, okay, obviously for large corporates on the RMB side, but then FMB commercial, you know, for hundreds of thousands of customers, credit is a critical enabler to grease the wheels of the economy, right? And you want to make that as easy as possible, but actually it is still in many cases quite a manual process. So that's where generative AI can really, it can write well, it can read well, it can summarize, it can do inferences that you want. And as long as you control it, that is like, that would be a new application that we're working on. But I can talk quite a bit about generative AI. I mean, we are really
seeing
a lot of application.
I see, and I'm going to ask you, what is your favorite case study of it? But what I see is its best use case is where you specify the source material. Instead of saying, ask the internet, and if it doesn't find the answer, it hallucinates. I'm with Naomi Klein. I don't think we should call it hallucinate. We should just call it what it is, which is software glitch.
Okay, that's a good point. I'll talk a bit about that. Okay, so if you're using generative AI, the first thing is address the privacy aspect. So if you're using ChatGPT, it does not give you privacy, the public version, right? So that would be on our bank computers. You cannot use ChatGPT. It does not access it.
Yeah.
But if you're using it in a protected environment, for example, we allow the use of Bing Chat because it actually sits behind two-factor authentication, and we have guarantees that the data is not used by Microsoft. But much better than that, even, is we have, for example, have FNB Chat for our staff.
Yes.
So our staff can ask questions on HR. I think I've showed this to you before.
You have.
On HR compliance and risk, etc. And all these documents have already been, let me say, vectorized. I know it sounds complicated, but we've changed that text into numbers that this large language model can really understand well.
Okay.
And if you want to find something, it can find it immediately. It doesn't have to go and read all those documents. It's already summarized them and captured them in a form that is easily searchable. And then it can give you an exact answer that is based on your internal information. Because as you say, the last thing you want, people say, well, it hallucinates or it's a glitch. It's not a glitch. That large language model was never fed with your data because why? We didn't publish it on the internet in the first place. And we want to make sure now that it's not using all of that other fake news that it has when it gives an answer. And actually, you can design it. We have a process The typical process is the retrieval augmented generation. I apologize for using technical terms, but really that is really how we make sure that it is actually answering a question based on internal facts. Now, the next generation that we're working on alongside that is not to just give you a factual answer from a document, but be able to do some kind of inference around your data, whether that's for advice or whether it's understanding a company's financials. These models now can generate SQL to interpret data in a structured database and give an answer and insert that back as part of an answer. That is really where I say the advances in generative AI is really is I've worked in this field for a very long time.
Yes.
And I'm really quite surprised by how fast it is progressing.
I'm loving your enthusiasm for it, because I mean I've been saying to people, don't worry, AI is not going to have a problem. And then just over a year ago, bang, a year and a half ago, suddenly it was a leap forward. And it's, I mean, I've been reporting on this industry for over 20 years. You often get you're game-changing, world-changing. This really is an extraordinary leap forward, because it uses the interface that we use, which is the spoken word or the written word. And you don't have to know how to code something. You can say, build me a website that does this, that, and it does it for you. I've, as long as I've been a technology journalist, I've used the analogy of driving a car. How much do you know about cars? I mean, you probably know a lot, but I know nothing. I get in the car, you turn the key ring. In fact, you don't even turn the key anymore. You just push the button, or you, in some cars, you just get in the car, and touch start or go. This is extraordinary. It's more economical and I don't understand anything about cars. I don't have to. Same with computers. Same with how generative AI is,
Yeah, and talking about cars, I mean, the irony is that the self-driving technology is still not quite there. I think people had this view that the future, if you look at sci-fi movies, that people would be doing the thinking and robots would be doing all the manual work. And actually, ironically, the generative AI is now, in the next 5 years, we're seeing there's going to be a massive shift in knowledge work being automated. Whereas actually, at least for now, the rollout of self-driving cars, robotics, etc., it's still expensive to have
robots
do work.
There's just too much data.
So if you think, if you want an electrician or a plumber, I mean, look at, nobody can project the future perfectly, but those jobs should be fairly safe for quite a long time because it actually requires a lot of different skills, and it's very difficult to build a robot that's going to do that. Whereas if you are in a pure knowledge economy, if you're a lawyer or an educator, or you are, let's say, a consulting physician, so a doctor that does not operate, a lot of the stuff that can be done there, diagnostic work, etc., that is actually inside the space of what LLMs will be really good at some point.
I mean, let's just look at one of those, because my counter to that, and I agree with you, but I think what we have as human beings is an ability to short circuit all of that. We don't think in silos. We think in a myriad of different ways. We are multidisciplinary, to use the technical term. We think, we're walking, we're looking at the sky, we're chewing gum, we're thinking about what to make our kid for dinner as we're picking up from school. We are all natural multitaskers in a way that these AI models aren't yet.
Yeah.
So what differentiates us over these models is our ability literally to think out of the box, as well as our empathy, as well as our intuition, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff in our own neural network called the brain that we haven't replicated in computers yet.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much of that ability to see the data. My mother's an architect. She turned 96 this week. And she always had this, she'd talk about engineers, and she'd say, as soon as engineers started using computers, they got less good at their job. I mean, she still worked with great engineers, but she said in the early days, you couldn't use a computer to calculate. If you use a calculator, and you could, so you had to have a sense of you know, weight and weight distribution. You're an engineer. I've always understood that analogy, and I've asked every engineer I've met, and I've spoken to lots of people, and it's kind of like that book, Smiler's Sense of Snow.
Yeah.
That Eskimos have 280 words for snow, and that as a result of the automation of some tasks, we have less of a sense of snow. But actually, we have a lot more than the AI or the computer or the robot will have, because we have our humanity.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I'm always careful of comparing the machine intelligence with human intelligence. I mean, some benchmarks may be interesting. A human has got, let's say, 100 billion neurons with maybe 1,000 connections each, so 100 trillion synapses. But the large language models are nearing that. You know, you're looking at many, many billions, maybe not quite 100 billion connections. So from a complexity point of view, they're not quite, you know, where the human brain is. But what is it quite interesting is actually people are developing, rather than building just larger and larger models,
yes,
these models actually consist of lots of different models, like even GPT-4.
Yeah.
In aggregate, there's an estimate of the number of parameters, but it's a lot of underlying models. And the same will be true of GPT-5 and of Gemini, I'm pretty sure as well. The details
what we were
disclosed.
Saying earlier about languages, those models are in effect different languages, and that builds up the capacity. What are some of the ways the bank is using it? What's your best AI case study?
So I'll talk about maybe like four areas that we're using generative AI in. And I'll start with something boring, but which I was at Google Next 3 weeks ago. And basically all the banks in the world are doing this. They're using this to be better at coding.
Yes.
So you may not be surprised that banks spend maybe a quarter of the OPEX in the bank goes to IT systems. And that is really leveraged through development. And that's always, there's always whatever you want to do for a customer, there's some need to implement it and some coding, et cetera. And even in our space, our 2,000 staff in Dynalytics, I mean, they're data scientists, they're data engineers, BI developers, and then a lot of specialists. But all of us are really putting stuff on a system. If we're not, what's in our head is nice, but it's actually what you're implementing that makes a difference to a customer. And being able to speak the language of coding is something I always say, if you think the large language models are good at Shakespeare, you know, try them out in Python or Java or C. They are really good at that as well. So being able to code better is a big accelerator for modernizing some, you know, existing legacy systems, for developing new applications, etc. So that sounds a bit boring, but that's actually, you know, that's quite a big use case. Then customer facing. So really, so on the FNB app, search and chat. You know, the fantastic thing about FNB is that we have got so many things we can give to you. But in a way, that is sometimes a curse.
Yeah.
So our customers are using a very small fraction of everything that we make available to you. And some things like eBucks, etc., you know, that can be, there's a lot of things to think about. So being able to give customer advice in plain language on what their exact needs are, being able to solve their problems and giving them that customer experience.
I'm a grateful beneficiary. I'm always trying to work out how to get more eBucks.
Yeah.
You know, and I can see it's gotten less complex to understand how the system works.
We absolutely try that. So Harry Kellen's got a big drive on simplicity to make things easier for our customers to understand. And I think generative AI is going to be a huge enabler in that regard. Then at the other side of that really is personalization. The ability to move from generic advertising, which obviously is important, to be able to personalize the message at an individual customer level. That is really, I guess, the holy grail of marketing. That's why the two tech firms are the biggest marketing firms in the world.
Of course.
We've spoken about that many times. So the ability to really give the customer that contextual message and package it in the right wording, even with the right images that the customer would appreciate, that is absolutely a next big wave. That we are doing that on our internet-facing side of the business, on our own internal channels, etc., on campaigning. You know, we try that out and we're like finding significant lift in click-through rates when you're giving somebody something contextual. And it may be relatively simple, But that's quite powerful. And then the fourth lever that I would say that we are really leveraging, and I showed you the FNB chat. Now, if you think about it, that sounds like, okay, well, that's just some information in the bank. But if you think about the number of related use cases that can enable across all of these areas, so in areas like risk and compliance and legal, they have got lots of processes where people are interpreting, you know, the customer's KYC documents in line with our regulations, where they are summarizing, let's say, you know, financial crime, which we're already pretty, I think that we're really good at. Maybe, you know, fraud investigations or the like. There are so many use cases where this is useful. Credit would be another one that I mentioned earlier, where, you know, you need to get the system to prepare something that's in line with certain specifications and documents. We've got guidelines and so on, and that really is an area where we can use this internal information which we vectorized along with customer data to really make, you know, internal processes significantly more efficient.
You had me at making the help menu more easy. Christoph, we could talk all day, and we have been. So, I mean, it's always great to have a conversation with you because you bring that, you know, pretty brilliant analytic brain of yours to it. I mean, the explanations of the large language models and the way they use languages is really great. So thank you for this. This has been a really fascinating conversation.
Toby, thank you. I mean, it's always a pleasure. And it's really, it's something that I'm very passionate about, that FNB, we're very passionate about how we can use technology to give our customers, you know, that that edge to help them just to take that next step in life. Thanks.
Great. You've been listening to the Stuff podcast. My name is Toby Shapshak. The executive director is Sally Hudson. Our director of audio is Hans Baumgarten. And you can read more every day on stuff.co.za. Please do like us and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. It really does help. Thanks for listening.